Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is delighted to have with us debut author C.K. Chow, whose new book is Good Fortune, and it's just out. Before we begin, I'd like to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of the book on order, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call at the Poison Pen or go online, and we can connect you with this truly fabulous debut. And I'd like to welcome C.K.
Hi, it's so lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me to do this event with you.
Thank you for taking time to be with us. My first question usually for authors is I'd like to know a little bit about them as a reader before they became published. And I know you have a background in English literature. Did you always want to be a writer? Who was C.K. before you published Good Fortune?
I did always want to be a writer, but I like to think of myself as a rambler. So I started out wanting to write screenplays, actually, and worked on that for a little bit before I thought about something that was a little bit more feasible for me, I think, than trying to land with my feet out there in California. And started to think about the freedom that novels give you when you're no longer constrained by budgets and practical things. So that's when I really started to explore fiction more.
Now, you probably had to have something to support yourself while you were writing, I'm guessing. So what kind of career path did you take while you were working on your book?
Yeah, so I have held many hats. I've kind of hopped around there as well. I looked for sort of things that were adjacent to the stuff that I had talent for, reading through things and things that allowed me the space and the time to write while I was still doing my job effectively in a way to avoid not getting fired. So I did real estate for a small amount of time, and then I transitioned from that into contracts work. So it's all very exciting. I like to think of my writing as kind of like my moonlighting job, my private detective job, as it were.
It's interesting that you say you worked a little bit in real estate, because I can see now why you chose one of your characters to have that, possibly that career later on in the book. So you decided you wanted to write a novel. What was the path to publication like for Good Fortune?
It was very unusual. I think it's a very unusual story all around, because it happened sort of right in the center of COVID lockdown. And it gave me the time and perhaps the undue energy to devote myself towards a long form project, because we just didn't have any other options. So I drafted it pretty much starting March, April 2020, when things were very, very uncertain. And from there, the submission process was pretty quick. The editing process was pretty quick. Everything kind of happened in spurts and starts, but then as a whirlwind kind of. And it was my first experience with that side of the process. So I just saw where things took me and tried to react in what I felt was reasonable time frames and asking questions. But it felt very much like there were always these little surprises along the way, which was fun.
It's interesting. And for many authors, getting a book published doesn't take that quick a trajectory. It's kind of, it can be up and down, but for you, it's interesting it did that. Timing is everything, I guess they say, in publishing life. What would you like to tell us about Good Fortune?
So I would say Good Fortune is, it's about a bunch of different stories. It's about a community trying to hold on to its sense of itself when things around it are changing. It's about being a young woman growing up and trying to find herself and figure out who she is and what she stands for. It's about New York City. And it's about a love story about finding someone who challenges you in a way to be a better person and how you can grow from that.
And lest anyone who's not familiar with the book might not realize, it's also kind of your homage to Pride and Prejudice. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a retelling. It's a modernized retelling.
Did you always want to do kind of your take on that story, or did that just come organically like your book itself?
It was kind of connected. So during the pandemic, I returned to a lot of comfort reads, as I'm sure many people did. And Pride and Prejudice was that read for me. And I've read that book many, many times. But every time you go back to a book that you know, you think about new things or you find new things about it to puzzle over. And when I was reading it, I was thinking about how much many of the concerns she's writing about felt modern to me in terms of money concerns, you know, and how attached she feels to her neighborhood and her community, but also how constrained she feels by it in a way that felt really realistic to me as someone who kind of bounced around different places, went to different schools. You know, every suburb has that place where you love to be there and you hate to be there at the same time. But if you hadn't been there, you know, you would be a completely different person. And I think she carries all of those themes through her book in a way that still resonates with all of us. And then on top of that, I think the dynamics between the characters really rang true to me as somebody who comes from a fairly large family. And I thought, you know, this could really transplant itself into the modern concerns of our time, you know, gentrification, and it can still be funny and fun.
It is, yeah, it's definitely got its moments. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of place in both Pride and Prejudice in your novel? Because you'd written something that I thought was rather interesting. You had wrote, Austen's representation of space is highly personal. Character is wedded to geography from the start. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so it's one of my, I guess, pet themes of interest. And it shows up in the book in Good Fortune as well. I think one of the things that I find very interesting about characters as a writer and as a person is that you're never the same person from place to place, from person to person that you meet. The person that you are when you're cooking Thanksgiving dinner with your family is not how you show up in a board meeting. And it's not how you show up when you're with your friends at a bar on Friday. But those are all fundamentally still you and pieces of you. And when I was reading Pride and Prejudice, I think one of the things that always sticks out to me is, you know, there's very little travel in the book that when it happens, she calls your attention to it. And that travel is what allows them to grow and change. To be a little bit cliche, people always talk about travel expanding your horizons. And I think that's true. You know, on a broader cultural sense, but also just when you meet new people, you revisit who you think you are every time. How am I going to introduce myself? You know, like on something like this, how am I going to introduce myself at a coffee shop if someone wants to borrow a napkin or make conversation? And you have a new opportunity every time to reinvent yourself, especially if it's someone you've never met or spoken to before.
That's true. I may have gotten the details wrong, and if I do, correct me, but Elizabeth definitely sees Darcy in a different light when she goes to Pennsylvania, is it? And she's
Yes. It's so in the original book, they kind of go to a mutual friend's house. In Pride and Prejudice, she goes to Charlotte's estate. And that's when things really start to come off the wagon and get a little bit bumpy. And I thought in my book, you know, when they travel out of state and the posturing of how closely she feels tied to New York City gets a little bit looser, how can she behave when she's no longer around the people that she's always around, the friend group or her family, or when she feels like she has to manage all these people? If those concerns aren't there and she can relax, what does that look like? Does that look like the same person? And I think she is mostly, but it's it gives her more room to play around, to be playful. And it opens up all of these conversations and possibilities that she hadn't realized were actually there until they do open up.
That's fascinating. My impression that place isn't just a geographic setting in Austen's work and your work, it's also kind of like a circle of society or where you're at in society. And I imagine, and correct me if I'm not right, but it was a challenge because Regency England is very stratified. You definitely have your place and the Bennets knew where theirs was. How did you manage to kind of make that seem realistic in modern day Chinatown? Because I did get that sense. I thought the same way that Elizabeth was being watched and you had to be careful of your reputation and Pride and Prejudice and you were all these things that you had to do or you could ruin yourself, your Elizabeth was also under scrutiny and you never knew when an auntie was going to be around the corner noting things down to tell everybody about it.
Yes, exactly. That was one of the fun things, you know, in moving it to Chinatown. I really wanted to tell a very Asian American story. And the hyphenation is important, I think. When you grow up Asian American in these communities, there's such a feeling of wanting to keep up this community. If these people understand you, they trust you. But because of that, you have this tension between the old traditions and wanting to be, you know, a little bit more assimilated and hyphenated American, as it were, as the younger generation. And so you kind of bounce between the two. But because you have a foot in both, there is a sense of, you know, all of these people know each other and they talk to each other. So what's the line that you try to walk in terms of, I want my mom to know very specific things about what I'm doing when I'm out of the house. And here are the things that I might actually be doing. And how can I negotiate this in a way where nobody's going to get too upset and I'm not going to get in too much trouble? I think it feels like a very common teen movie theme to some extent, but there's a heightened level of meaning to it because it's so bound up in this idea of culture and what it means to kind of have that continuity of cultural identity that feels very modern.
Well, you succeeded. It definitely put me in Chinatown. One of the other things that I thought might have been a challenge, but I think one that you mastered, is anyone who takes on Austin's work has to be able to evoke her sense of wit for which she's known, but also be able to write in their own voice. And I think you kind of captured it. I wrote down a couple examples because I really thought they were quite good, but there's lots more. Reaching into her purse, Charlotte fanned them out in her palm, white, off-white, and cream cardstocks embossed in standard type, emptied of personality and full of ego. And that's such a well-crafted sentence.
Thank you.
The key to pleasing parents was the same as writing a good apartment listing, lying through the teeth. And yes. Then your take on Lady Catherine, which I thought was really insightful and modern too. She was a Pez dispenser of little judgments on everything from styles of fashion. Juicy should never be described anything except fruit. And even then only on rare occasions to etiquette and technology. So did that come naturally, or was that something you really, that's an insane question, but are you naturally funny? How do you work at it?
I think everybody works at being funny a little bit. Not to, you know, go too off the path with references here, but I always think about that Monty Python sketch about Oscar Wilde at a party where he's just kind of panicking and trying to think of the next bon mot to say before somebody realizes he's not as funny as his reputation makes him out to be. But to go to your question, the voice was very important to me. I knew it was important to the book, and I knew you need to land it from the first sentence in a book like this to make the entire concept work. So it was something that I really focused on, and it probably took me so many iterations to find the right style because it had to feel gossipy and intimate, but also have that omniscience and also be clever enough that, you know, she would make you laugh or she would make you smile while she's giving you all the dish, you know. And as soon as I had the first phrase, you know, presenting the Chens, I was like, this is it. She has to know everything and she has to only give you what she feels comfortable with giving you. It's a very social voice. It's a very party voice, but it's also not overly salacious. I think it was a very, very hard thing to balance, to be honest.
You definitely succeeded. It's a terrific tribute to Austin as well as a illustration of your own sense of humor. One of the other things that might have been a challenge, it may not have been, but the mother in Pride and Prejudice, Mrs. Bennet, on the one hand, she can drive readers crazy because she's so obsessed with making sure her daughters marry well. I mean, that's her goal in life, her raison d'etre. How do you translate that to the 21st century? Well, you did that with a mother who just wants what's best for her daughters, just like Elizabeth's mother did.
Right. So when I was thinking about it, you know, the worry and anxiety comes from a very practical and real place. And when I thought about consequences, her in the original novel, concern over her daughters is really that she doesn't want them to be destitute. The estate has to be entailed to a male heir. So whenever Mr. Bennett dies, they're all essentially going to be homeless unless they have a backup plan. And I found that much more humanizing, even though, as you said, she is very frustrating and very over the top. And when I thought about what felt relevant to that point today, it's job security. You know, you have your kids graduating high school, graduating college. You don't want them to be lying around being like, I'm going to find a job someday. You want them eventually to be self-sufficient and to be able to have good lives. And I think as, children of immigrants or refugees, et cetera, there's an added pressure there because there's this idea that your parents have sacrificed and struggled so that you can go and be more successful and make their lives more comfortable as they age. Mrs. Bennett in my novel, I think she sees her daughters as being very, very cavalier about it. You know, they're 16, 17, and she wants them to be thinking about med school, law school, things that are proven. And the main tension between her and Elizabeth is what I think is, you know, can be a very American concern of like, well, I am entitled to find my own life in my own way. And these are the things I want to be doing. I want to be working in politics, or I want to be working in photography, these things that are very, very uncertain. And who can't understand that? You know, you always want what's best for your kid, but you also have to give them space to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Are you an amateur photographer yourself? Or
I am not, actually, but I have known my fair share of amateur photographers.
Well, it's really kind of, again, a very clever way to, it allows your Elizabeth to see people and things in a different light, because as a photographer, you're framing the subject.
Right, exactly.
Did your own experience, brief or not, with real estate kind of influence any of your Mrs. Chen's action in the book?
That's a great question. I'm not sure how familiar anyone is with the New York real estate market, but it is basically the real estate market everywhere else in the United States, ratcheted up probably about 10 to 50% in intensity. And I saw in her many brokers that I have interacted with or worked with, or that you might see on reality TV, who are kind of a little bit fluffed up by the sense of what they can do, and have a very sharp eye for what they think is sellable or what they can achieve, and are kind of slippery. You know, they'll always push their way into a room if they think they can make a deal or a commission. And I do not have that quality. It's something that I witness from afar and I'm kind of, you know, a little curious and envious of. But there are certain kinds of people where that's how they work, that's how they move. And the business as a whole, I think, operates on that more than other industries. And I find that really interesting.
Now, this may be a question you don't want to answer, but if you wish to, which Bennett sister do you identify with most closely? Is there one that you, despite you don't want people to know, you think, yeah, that's me?
I think, you know, every person who handles this story in their heart wants to say Elizabeth because she's so clever and fun. But I worry, or I secretly think that I have a touch of Kitty about me, especially as a teenager. She's just very, she's a people pleaser. She really likes to just want to know that she's doing the right thing, and she's maybe a little bit over eager and emotional, revealing perhaps a little bit too much of myself on here, but I find her very charming, and I think it's a very young feeling concern, and I really like that about her.
Not being from New York, and there are probably people tuning in who are also not from that area, but you touch upon gentrification as being an issue, and how does that impact New York and Chinatown?
So it was something I was thinking about when I thought about when the book takes place. So the book takes place in the early 2000s, or post 9/11 New York. And what was happening in New York at the time was there was a lot of conversation about Chinatown being so far downtown and there being a lot of real estate kind of moving around because, you know, a lot of people moved out and didn't want to be down there. And there's always these conversations that come up about Chinatown ceding blocks or you know, buildings to other communities because it's all pressed up against each other. So things kind of shift, you know, Chinatown moved into Little Italy and Little Italy moves back, that kind of thing. But for me, when I thought about how to frame it, when we think about our hometowns, our communities, the place that we come from, what we care about are the people there, you know, and I wanted to center it around family businesses, mom and pops, in a way that felt very, very understandable for us now, you know, places where you just go and you hang out, you know, the owner might recognize you, and it becomes a place that stands in for your hometown. When I go home, there's a diner I always go to, and I love that diner, and it's been there for, you know, 15, 20 years. I couldn't tell you a thing about really who owns it, anybody's names or anything like that, but when I think about it, that's what represents that experience for me. And I think everybody has that kind of a place that they think of when they were growing up. And in the space of the novel, making that a restaurant where they're working, but it's also this, you know, food that can feel familiar and you can get anywhere outside of the city. It was really about, what are you trying to protect, or what do you want to remember about this idea of home that you carry with you? Can it be protected? Should it? And for me, those answers are yes and yes, you know.
Now, are you just writing solely now? Do you still have a day job?
I do still have a day job.
And is that in publishing, if I'm correct? Or
yes, it is.
Was working in publishing, some people might think, wow, that gives you a leg up on other authors out there because you know the industry. Was it an advantage to you knowing what you know about publishing, or was it in some ways a disadvantage to you as a writer?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the advantage gets overstated sometimes, you know. Sometimes it feels a little bit like you're trying to sell sausage, but you also know how it's made, and it's a little bit distasteful in both directions. I would say where it helped was in setting my expectations. There's a lot of very peculiarity, like very specific publishing stuff in terms of their scheduling, how they handle certain aspects of the process. You know, and I had a great team at Harper Via. They were very communicative and they, you know, talked me through things I didn't know, but I have known, you know, that it's not like there's a standard script everywhere you go. And so sometimes if I, you know, was in a kind of lull waiting for updates or waiting for news, I didn't drive myself crazy because I was like, this is the business. I'm just going to not hear until I hear, or there will just be kind of these waiting times where conversations are happening and I'll be looped into it when it's important for me to be there.
Knowing what you know now as a published author, if you could go back to when you were first starting out, what advice would you give yourself as a writer?
I think I would tell myself to start submitting way later. Like, I think there's a lot of times when the eagerness and the ambition to put yourself in somebody else's hands overshoots probably where the work is at that particular point. You know, and I had been writing and I'd been trying to figure out a story or to do this since I was in my early 20s, you know, submitted a lot of things in my early 20s that probably were inadvisable. And I think sitting and spending more time with the work itself and trying to figure out what it was trying to do before thinking about whether or not I could sell it is probably something I would tell myself to focus on.
Let's talk a little bit about you as a reader, because I'm guessing Jane Austen is an important touchstone in your life as a reader. What was your kind of experience with her through the reader's lens? Are there other books, other authors that you still look back and think those were important to me, those helped shape me as a reader and possibly as a writer?
Yeah. Jane Austen is funny. I think I really grew with her. She really grew with me. I encountered her for the first time in school reading, as I'm sure 95% of people do. And I was too young for her at the time, actually. So I found her very difficult, and I didn't really understand much of what was going on. But I read enough where I felt compelled to revisit it every few years. And as I kind of got older and my reading comprehension got better, I was able to understand more of it and to enjoy more of it. And then I read all of her other works and have continued to develop and evolve this relationship with her. Pride and Prejudice, I think, is my favorite novel of hers because it is always funny to me. I've read it so many times, and every time I laugh at the jokes, and that's how you know it's very, very good as a comedy. And I find something new in it every time. I think there's such economy in the way that she, you know, writes and presents these plots. And I also think she's very, very smart about kind of personal politics, people learning how to be in the world in terms of money, in terms of relationships, that I think are really ahead of her time, in a manner of speaking. And there's always something to pull from that. But as a reader, I think you can learn everything. You can learn anything from anything that you pick up. There's certain writers that I have a deep appreciation for, that I come back to again and again, because I think they really made a strong impression on me. Zadie Smith is one of those writers. I'm really excited for the new book that she has coming out. But she's just got an incredible sense of voice, very stylized, but very graceful about it. Nimble, I think. The way that she lets plots kind of emerge out of character, and the way that she makes every character sound so different and tied to a place is something that I am really impressed by and always want to learn from. White Teeth knocked me out the first time I read it, and I go back to it a lot. Just the way that she plays with characters and jumps between them. I'm a big fan of kind of spare prose, I should say. So I look to, you know, Raymond Carver, someone whose language I really admire. The way he sets up every story, there's not much meat on it. It's really just kind of bone, but it gets you every time. And Joan Didion, I think, for the same reasons. I really appreciate what people can do with a very spare sentence. I would love to reach that level one day, but it's a process.
What I'm getting from what you're saying is I can see kind of your English literature background coloring your opinions. And this may be a question that you don't have the answer to, but is there any author and that readers might be surprised to find that you do like that doesn't fit that kind of mold? Like, do you secretly read Jackie Collins or somebody? Or
the name sounds familiar, but I don't actually know who that is.
That's because you're much more refined than she wrote Hollywood Wives, but anyone who maybe writes less,
maybe.
But I'm thinking, it sounds like the authors, and this is you connecting as a reader, the authors you love, you're reading for their writing style, for their language, mm-hmm. for the way they use the story. But I guess, is that just you, or do you ever think, okay, I just want to read somebody just for the sheer fun of the story? Like, I guess the equivalent would be like a popcorn movie or something like that.
I will say I'm a big romance novel fan, so that might be surprising. I love to dive into that kind of genre. I really enjoy historical romances. So thank you. Courtney Milan is someone whose books I've really liked. Sherry Thomas. There's really just something very escapist and fun to it. And I love the structures, how similar they are. But it's not something I talk about in public much. I do really enjoy it. I wouldn't call myself an expert by any means.
Well, no, you've got excellent taste. And for anyone listening in, Sherry Thomas and Courtney, they don't just write good stories. They're also experts with the language too, especially their stories. So that's great. Jane Austen has inspired many different writers, movie makers, things like that. Are there particular, I'm not sure what the word is, spinoffs, pastiches, homages, that you think, okay, that's something I really appreciate?
I think Bridget Jones' Diary is one I really appreciate. The tone matters much more to me than kind of being absolutely faithful to the plot. And it's like you asked earlier, I think the voice is the hardest part to land and the most important. So anything that really has that, I'm always going to be fonder towards. But I have seen many, many an adaptation, and I generally enjoy all of them. I think everybody comes to Jane Austen with different lenses in terms of what they're looking for. And I'm open to most of them, but I think the ones that allow her to be a little bit more cutting, a little more funny, those are the ones I really enjoy.
Now, this may be another question you wish to put on hold or not answer, but do you want to tell us anything about what might be in the works for you as an author?
So I am trying to figure out what the next project is going to be. I think there's a lot of things that I'm interested in thematically that I'd like to explore, and I'm still trying to figure out the right angle to do that. It's hard to come off a debut and kind of dive into the next one right away.
It is. And I think one of the other challenges for authors is there's been this expectation that every author is the same and that you write a book every 6 months, and that, and some authors work that way. Other authors, it might be a year or 2 years, or they can't control the time frame. It's just when the story comes.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking as a reader, I do have much wider taste than I think my answers might have suggested that. And because of that, I have lots of different kind of concerns and interests that I want to dive into. And, you know, I'm looking at social media and I'm looking at all of these kind of cultural things. You know, read a cult novel recently that there's just so many things that I want to be puzzling over. And I don't necessarily know how to jump from where this is to where that will be. But that'll be the fun of figuring out that book, I think.
That is both the fun and the challenge, because I'm guessing that you don't necessarily want to be put into the corner of just being a Jane Austen knockoff writer. You have other things that you want to explore literally.
Right.
How can readers learn more about you and your works? Are you on social media? What exactly is Caroscopes?
Oh, wow. You did your research. Incredible. So I'm on some social media. I'm terrible at social media, I must admit. So I just have a Twitter account. It's at Chow CK Writes. I am also on my website, which is not updated as frequently as it should be, but that is chowck.com. Caroscopes was something that I started two summers ago. I am an amateur hobbyist at astrology. I love reading about it. No judgment, please. I find it to be a very interesting personality test, Rorschach test. It's just a fun thing to read about. And I'm also an avid news junkie, which is probably a problem. So when I was thinking about responding to the kind of news items that I was seeing, essays that I was reading, I wanted to put them all in a place where I could kind of unpack my thoughts about it. And I thought, what better way to frame this than as just a general horoscope, you know, me reacting to different movies or articles or, you know, discourses that float around, and just having a landing space to kind of pull those threads further apart. I think we need more room to explore our ideas before we get out and start fighting about them with other people on social media. And so that was where I wanted to put mine. I haven't updated as much as I should, but it is always something percolating in the back of my mind.
That's great. I can't believe how quickly our time has flown by.
I've
been honored to have debut author C.K. Chow with us, whose new book is Good Fortune. It's a terrific read, whether you're familiar with Jane Austen or not. It reads perfectly fine on its own. I'd like to thank C.K. for taking time to visit with The Poison Pen. I'd like to thank everyone tuning in for joining us for another author chat at The Poison Pen Bookstore. And we hope to see you virtually next time.
Yes, thank you all so much. And I hope that I can visit the Poison Pen in person one day.
We would love to have you. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them and your help would be appreciated, please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.